matter of time, I suppose.
Welcome back to Watchmen Minute, where we're examining the director's cut of Zack Snyder's Watchmen, one vegetarian pacifist at a time. My name is Travis Bowe from the Real Comic Heroes podcast.
I'm Eric Nash from the upcoming Almost Famous Minute.
And my name is Rebecca Johnson. I'm one of the hosts of a podcast called Supergirl Radio, and I'm a contributor to a podcast about the DCEU and some of Zack Snyder's films called a Justice League Universe podcast.
Welcome back, Rebecca. So glad you could join us for some Zack Snyder-y goodness.
Well, thank you for having me back. I enjoy talking about it.
This is Minute 157, which starts with Night Owl and Rorschach approaching Karnak and ends with the pair attempting to ambush Ozymandias. But firstly, I want to say happy anniversary, Eric.
Oh, yeah. You too, Travis.
It's
not when we got married.
No, we just discovered that this episode is coming out on the... 1 year anniversary of our first episode going out. So, yay.
That's a huge thing. So, congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you.
Takes a lot of dedication.
It's been a good run. So, we get to see this door that Night Owl and Rorschach are trying to get open and get a little glimpse of this laser tool that Night Owl is carrying.
I love this shot because the way the sparks come out is, to me, it sort of gives off a Dr. Manhattan vibe, even though it's not Dr. Manhattan. I just think it's a neat connection to him because the blue and the glow is it looks like Dr. Manhattan to
sure.
me. But I just love the coloring in the shot where it pushes in to the door. Just this whole sequence is very blue, and it just makes everything feel so much colder because we are in the Arctic. but I love the way the color, the blue pops in that shot.
Yeah. I have this kind of working theory. Mostly it was based around, the power source for Archie. And I think that in this universe where Manhattan has existed since the, 60s, that a lot of the technology and a lot of it is based off of Dr. Manhattan or in some way derived from him. And so the power source or the energy that, Archie gives off is this blue glow that I'm guessing is somehow related to Manhattan. And then I didn't even think about these blue sparks that would be coming off here, which, I'm sure they made them blue here in the movie. So that must have been for a reason. So
I 100% buy that theory.
Yeah.
I think it's a great theory.
All that being said, they wrench open these doors and I get very tense at moments like this and throughout most of this minute where we know that they're supposed to be quiet and it just seems like everything they're doing is just creating noise. They're sliding open these doors that don't want to open and they're metal and they echo and they're not quiet about entering and they're talking and it doesn't seem like we don't know how long they travel to get to this the wings over here on the side of this big room, but even once they're there they're moving around and it's almost like, for me, it's sort of involuntary for, if you're watching someone underwater, I instantly hold my breath, So seeing someone sneak around, I just feel I tense up a little bit. And then, like I said, every time they make all this noise, it just makes me, that much more nervous for them, I guess.
Sure, they're making a lot of noise and they're probably going to get caught. But don't they look good? They look great. We get a really nice view of Night Owl's great snowsuit that I love so much. The cape is just so majestic, and you get a really good shot of the mask and the new cowl as they open this door. And of course, Rorschach is probably still freezing, but he's not admitting to it. But yes, yeah, so they are making a lot of noise, but they look great. I think that's really all that matters here.
And there's like, at a certain point, it's like we, the audience knows that Adrian knows they're here. So on one level, it's like there is no suspense as far as are they going to sneak up on him? Because we know that they can't. They don't know that. So that's obviously where the suspense comes in. And that's, I think, why it works really well. But.
And I guess maybe because I'm so obsessed with the snowsuit, now that I'm kind of going frame by frame, I'm looking at the part of his mask, Night Owl's mask. So it's adjustable. Like there's a piece of it that comes off his normal cowl. So I think that's really cool. Like the snowsuit part of it goes on top of the original cowl. So I guess that is sort of. I guess it functions like some sort of winter protection. So I think that we get a really good glimpse once they sort of step into the doorway. You get a really good shot of Night Owl's the mask covering of his cowl.
Yeah, and I don't know how much heat that's helping keep in, but it might just be more of a camouflage thing to help him just color, you know, just that. Blending in with the rest of the material of the cape and everything.
And speaking of clothing, because I guess I'm really focused in on this, but Rorschach is wearing a scarf. Does he normally wear a scarf? I'm trying to think of if that's normally part of his attire or if he's just wearing kind of a scarfy looking thing when he's in the cold.
And he tucks it in.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
So I think he might normally have a scarf, you know, there around somewhat slightly around his neck normally, but not as bunched, you know, not as tied up, you know.
Yeah, I feel like it's there.
Protect him from the elements.
I think it is regularly there. It may not feel as prominent as it does here because, yeah, he may have, like Eric said, kind of adjusted it so that it's, I don't know, providing a little bit more warmth.
I guess I never thought about that or paid attention to it until I got so worried about him being cold in the Arctic. So yeah, now I'm gonna have to go back and pay attention to that all throughout the film.
One thought I had about, you know, Rorschach here in the cold, it doesn't seem like his mask is affected by the cold, and I know I would really have liked to see some kind of reaction of this, you know, his ink blots or some sort of sense that they were morphing a little bit slower than they normally would. Because it kind of hit me this morning, you know, I mentioned yesterday my drive to work being, you know, literally sub-zero temperatures, and they were today as well. And you know, you notice when your car is that cold, the radio display, the car radio, like the, you know, when I turn the volume up, the little digital numbers, they move slower. And so it kind of got me thinking about like this layer of, you know, of I guess ink or this we know from the book, you know, his mask is a layer of black and white fluids that don't, you know, they don't contaminate each other, but they're trapped between two layers of fabric. So it'd be nice to see that fluid maybe just react a little bit to the cold, and I mean, we obviously don't see him, like there's not a close-up on him right after they get out of the cold, so there wouldn't be a lot of time to devote to something like that, but it's just something I thought of.
I think that's a really cool thing to think about because, I mean, when I'm out in the cold, I move a little slower. It takes a little while for my car to warm up. So I think that's a great point that something would slow it down. You know, the cold would slow it down.
So we get to what they kind of start talking about once they get these doors open, and Dan mentions that Adrian's a pacifist and being a vegetarian. So of course, or then he says, you know, he's never killed anyone in his life, which, you know, that you know of, Dan.
Well, I think the important part of that exchange is that Rorschach says Hitler was a vegetarian.
Yeah.
He's trying to make the point that, you know, just because somebody's a vegetarian doesn't mean they can't kill anybody.
Right.
But what I tried to do some digging into this Hitler vegetarian thing, and that apparently is a myth by all accounts that I could see, that Hitler wasn't actually a vegetarian. So, and if you do like an internet search, there's a lot of stuff about Hitler and vegetarianism.
Yeah. So it's at best, if in a sense it is true that at some point he was a vegetarian, well, it's actually only that he might have been from like 37 on is what I found.
That's what I read.
So
too.
It's not like he was a vegetarian his whole life, and therefore that's why. You know, that has something to do with his atrocities.
Yeah, I read that he apparently consumed meat up until around 1937. And then by 1942, he was a self-identified vegetarian. Oh. And then there were like a few different reasons as to why. Like one, I guess, source said that he was an animal lover and hated the idea of animals suffering. So think about that for a minute.
Gosh.
Yeah. one account said, you know, it was just a personal health thing, which I kind of could believe. I remember for some reason that takes me to Captain America, the First Avenger. And they have Arnim Zola is their, you know, they're captive, and he claims he's a vegetarian and that meat doesn't agree with him, and that he kind of gets made fun of for having like a weak, you know, weak system for not being able to eat meat or whatever. And I could kind of see Hitler being, you know, someone that meat didn't agree with. I don't know why. There was another reason for his vegetarianism that, you know, he wanted to prove his discipline as part of some German pride sort of thing. And I also read that he didn't drink or didn't smoke either. So it could have been like a, something where he didn't do certain things just to prove a point sort of thing. I'm not sure, but, I felt a little weird about looking up, like, you know, if he was vegetarian and why, because, you know, I've had plenty of friends that are, you know, vegetarian or vegan, and I've also witnessed them being like grilled about why they are vegan or vegetarian, which I think is one of the rudest things that you can ask a person, like if they are vegetarian and or vegan, like asking them why, because I've like I said, I've witnessed it so many times, like, you know, how could you not eat meat? And, you know, that sort of thing. And I think it's just one of the worst things you can do to, like, to someone who's made a simple choice about what not to eat, you know. So,
if it's a matter of health, some kind of health issue. I mean, it's like you're prying into their health, you know, which I was kind of raised to not pry into people's.
Yeah.
So do we think that because there is some sort of division or contrary opinions of whether or not Hitler was a vegetarian, do we think Rorschach is right? Do we think he's correct when he says that? Or do we think he's maybe buying into a little bit of a myth? I couldn't decide.
He's a bit of a conspiracy theorist.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess that fits. Yeah.
Well, but I kind of take it like Rorschach's just telling Dan, like, don't let, you know, personality aspects of someone's personality, like, I guess, hide the fact that they've done horrible things. So, like, yeah, he might be a vegetarian, but you know, that doesn't matter when they've committed atrocities or whatever. So,
oh yeah, I really like that about this moment is that the difference between Night Owl and Rorschach is very defined. Mm-hmm. Night Owl seems to want to believe in the best in people and wants to believe in his friend, his coworker, if you will. And Rorschach is a very cynical character, and he's pretty much already convinced that, you know, Adrian's up to no good, and he's going to do whatever it takes to stop him. So I think that it's really well written and well performed in terms of showing the differences between these two characters.
Yeah. My last little bit about the whole Hitler thing was I did read that in 2017, a team of French scientists examined some of his remains and found no traces of meat fibers in the tartar in his teeth. So that was adding to the, you know, to him being vegetarian, which I didn't see that it was a myth.
He just took really good care of his teeth.
Yeah, sure.
But, he flossed daily.
Yeah. So this next thing that Rorschach says, you know, he says, "You're squeamish, leave him to me." And is that Rorschach asking or telling?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Is he asking, if you're squeamish, leave him to me?
It's an implied if.
Right. Or is it, you're squeamish, mm-hmm. so leave him to me? Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure which one.
That's a toss-up. I guess I think Rorschach doesn't think that Dan is up to this.
Right.
I think he thinks that Night Owl Dan is not going to go the extra mile it's going to take to stop Adrian and save the day. I don't think he thinks he's going to do whatever it takes. So Rorschach probably thinks, well, I'm going to have to take care of this.
Yeah. Well, I think I was flipping through the book in around this section before we got on here tonight. And, you know, in the book, it's a little bit different. They get all the way here. And then Dan says, like, so that's how does he put it? So I guess I should ask, like, what's our plan here? And Rorschach says, you know, subdue him first and then go from there. Basically, just Rorschach doesn't want to leave anything to chance. You know, they might be wrong about Adrian being the bad guy here, but Rorschach wants to pin him to the ground first and then, you know, deal with the questions later. So I do think that's part of his approach here is definitely, we're not going to get a second chance. So hit him hard and then we'll deal with it after the fact. Once he's down, then we can have all the time we want to, you know, ask questions and figure things out. So
I do like the idea that, and we'll see this moving into this minute, that Night Owl and Rorschach think they can take Adrian down.
Sure.
So they have a real optimism and self-esteem about them that they think they're going to go in there and just handle business.
Yeah.
So, you know, good for them.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, they're both accomplished fighters, you know. But yeah, even Rorschach says in his last journal entry a few weeks ago or several episodes, you know, that they're going to face him alone in the snow, and he says he can't think of a more dangerous opponent. So they knows that they don't have great odds.
I guess that's what makes them heroic,
right?
Is that they know they're going up against somebody who's pretty powerful and who can probably take them down without much effort, but they're still going to do it because they know that's what needs to be done.
Sure. We see Night Owl's kind of, I guess we see Adrian from another angle, from Night Owl and Rorschach's kind of vantage point. We see him watching his screens again. The only things I could really see here on the screens were there's a very prominent jet fighter maybe taking off. I saw one screen with a mushroom cloud kind of explosion. And I definitely saw an MTV logo on one of the screens.
The Moon Man.
Yeah. And then you could hear, like, as the camera pans away from Adrian and we go to, you know, follow Night Owl and Rorschach, you hear suddenly one of the screens that cuts to static, and maybe ends up, maybe there are two screens that, or possibly more, but you can definitely hear that staticky noise and see at least one or two of the screens cut to static. And I like to think that that's, you know, somewhere in the world that station is maybe no longer broadcasting. Because I think it feels like the rest of the screens might be a lot more of the talking head style news reporters. So however long it's been since he's been watching TV, I think some of the channels might be switching over to more news and things like that.
Breaking news.
That makes his chair, Adrian's throne chair, so much creepier that he's pulled up this extravagant chair to sit in front of these screens waiting for the world to end, is basically what he's doing.
Sure.
And that is just... That is some grim stuff. And I like in this shot, though, this shot from Rorschach's perspective, that Adrian has stood up. He's not sitting in the chair anymore. So he knows they're coming for him. So now I think he's getting ready for what's about to come. Mm-hmm. So he's gotten up from that creepy chair to watch the world end.
Yeah. And I like before, like we kind of see Rorschach in the background, but as it pans across Adrian's face, and we get this, you know, real subtle work by Matthew Good, just, you know, as he's watching, we get to see his face. And it's just, it sells the idea that he's watching and waiting to hear the worst. You know, he's not, doesn't feel great about this. He's just resigned to the fact that he's soon going to start hearing just all the horror and the, you know, the accounts of all, you know, news flooding in. Yeah,
to your point, he doesn't look like he's happy about it. He's not watching these screens with a lot of enthusiasm or happiness. He's very serious and concentrated on it. So it's almost like this is his mission, his job. He feels like this is what he needs to do. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that he's excited about.
Right. Yeah.
There is just, I mean, it's just the one, he's looking at one screen, it seems like, and he just shifts his eyes a bit to his left and up a little bit, maybe. You know, so he's only looked at two screens in that matter of time, but seemingly.
Yeah.
Unless he can be peripherally, slightly peripherally,
sure,
looking at, being aware of all, a lot more of the screens than just one.
Oh, yeah. You can definitely hear, like, the clapper commercial.
Yeah.
So he definitely isn't concerned about, you know, taking in all of these screens.
Sure.
So, did anyone here have a clapper in their house?
No, but I was always kind of wanting one to try it. But it always felt a little lazy.
Mm. Yeah, we never had one either.
I don't think we ever had one, but my dad was a little into things similar to it. You know, having a switch that you can essentially put on that's remote that you can put on an end table. That you know, will control a certain lamp, light, whatever.
I could see that.
Yep.
There's also, like, you can hear a sitcom sort of laugh track. Definitely noticed that. And then this kind of going back to what I was saying earlier about just them trying to be quiet, and you can just hear Rorschach, you know, as he does that. This kick-ass move, you know, where he drops down, but he still, you can just hear the impact of his boots, you know, as he sneaks around and stuff. And it's, I mean, again, we know that Adrian's aware of their presence, but it's like, I feel like they should be more, you know, silent than they end up being, but
they think they're being pretty slick.
Yeah, yeah.
Rorschach is doing his best ninja impersonation.
Snake eyes.
Yeah.
He is being so methodical about, you know, his parkour, where he takes it and, you know, he separates it out so that he doesn't do it all in one movement, which is actually, it looks really cool. It does, but you're right. Like the, you know, the footsteps with his boots, you can hear it. I almost kind of, when I watch it, I'm like, why didn't you just like take your boots off at this point and just walk around in your socks? That'd be a little quieter. But then it wouldn't work, because then when you actually fight Adrian, you'd be fighting in your socks. That's kind of dumb. Mm-hmm. So I don't guess I know what the alternative for them would be. But yeah, I mean, they are a little clunky. They are making a lot of noise.
And I think going back to something we've talked about, you know, several times, is the enhanced strength that everyone in this movie kind of tends to have. And I think that's definitely on display here as he does that. You know, he lets himself fall off the side of this, I don't know, 10-foot tall stone. And then before landing, he grabs the top edge with one hand and completely supports his entire, you know, weight, which I can buy that, but to do it as you're dropping, to catch yourself, I think is slightly a moment of some slight enhancement that we see there, but it still looks 100% badass. So
yeah, Rorschach has the cooler move in this minute, because Night Owl, he's just walking down the stairs. He's not doing anything cool, and right. He's got the cool cape. And this makes me personally sad, because Night Owl takes off the snowsuit in this minute.
Right.
I hate to see it go, because I'm obsessed with it. Now he's just, you know, original recipe Night Owl. So I'm sorry to see the snowsuit go, but yeah, I'm a little disappointed he didn't do like a cool superhero landing with the cape. Right. He's just walking down the stairs,
didn't drop in through the skylight.
Oh, that would have been cool,
right? I don't have anything else. What about you guys?
I just really like getting to see in this minute, getting to see more of the interior of the Fortress of Solitude, as it were. So it's neat to see in there, because it looks big, but it is very, it feels very cold on the inside, just as it would be on the outside. There are a few little trinkets that Adrian has in the background of his shot that he has. Like, it looks like he has like maybe a mummy back there. So a lot of things that fit the Egyptian feel, the Egyptian design of his place here in the Arctic. But it just feels so cold and separated out. And I guess maybe that's, you know, reflective of maybe this solitude that he has in Karnak, that he doesn't want any, you know, he probably doesn't have a lot of visitors. so it's not a real homey place, but I think it's very reflective of his character, especially at this point in the film.
Yeah, that's something I didn't even really think about, is just that set design, you know, and for the most part, yeah, this whole space is was built. You know, it's it gets a little CGI once you get up into the glass stuff above, but for the most part, the all the stairs and all the statues and the, you know, all that stuff was built on the set. But yeah, there's definitely some coldness to it. Like, he's specifically gone with like that black, I'm guessing like an onyx type stone for the main part of the floor and the area that he's on where he's watching TV, surrounding himself with
the unit that's holding the TVs. That's duplicated in the shelving that has his artifacts on it behind him.
Oh, because
you can see the lights in the, you know, seconds 36, 35, 36, the lights on each side of the TV unit, entertainment unit. And one of those lights you can see then when you progress to 47 and on for a little bit behind him.
Do you all get the sense that Rorschach and Night Owl have been here before? Like, would they have visited Adrian here before? I always kind of wondered that. I don't think they say anything about it in the film.
Right.
Yeah, they don't talk about the thing that, you know, people in the movies will often talk about when they're entering a new structure, at least to them. We have to find plans of the building or anything like that. There's no
yeah.
talk like that.
I don't know that I get any sense that they've been here before. I almost want to say that there's something in the book about Dan visiting Adrian in Antarctica, but I can't remember if I'm making that up or if that was... I can't recall now.
Yeah, I just think about all the times, you know, Batman or Wonder Woman have visited Superman in the Fortress of Solitude. So I wondered if that was kind of a similar situation where some of the Watchmen might go pay him a visit sometimes.
Yeah, I don't know how long he's had this facility either. I don't get the sense that it's been like a base of operations for, certainly not for his crime fighting, you know, career. I think it's been more just in his later years of planning to save the world with his energy developments. So anything else?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think that's it for me.
Okay. Rebecca, what is your history with Watchmen?
Well, a few years after I started reading comics pretty heavily, I guess that would have been sometime around 2005, I got into comics. I just wanted to start reading them. And one of my good friends, Mike, he was sort of my comics expert at the time. He was the guy feeding me a lot of books to read. He was like, you got to read this and you got to read this. It was a lot of, you know, Batman and Teen Titans and things like that, stuff that he loved.
Sure.
And one of the things that he sort of, you know, really encouraged me to read was Watchmen. He was like, this is one of, you know, the greatest comic book stories that has ever been written. And he really hyped it up. And the movie, I think that at the point when he was encouraging me to read the graphic novel, it was probably like maybe, I guess, a year before this film came out, because I read the graphic novel and then I remember seeing the first trailer that came out. And I couldn't see myself, but I felt like my eyes got really big when I saw Archie come up out of the water, because that was something that I was like, oh my gosh, that's from the book. It looks just like the book. And that was one of the coolest parts about the film experience for me, was having read the graphic novel and seeing how faithful this film really is. I mean, they do change some things, even in the minutes that I've talked to you guys about. A lot of the dialogue has changed. A lot of the looks of things, the designs have changed a little bit. And I think the film improves upon the book quite a bit in a number of places and elements. But I just thought it was really cool to be able to experience what I saw in the book, see it be brought to life. So I think it's Watchmen is a really special story because it's very expansive, I guess. It's very there's a lot to it, to the story, to the characters, and to see that the film did as best as anybody could to capture the heart of that story and make it into a watchable movie. You know, Zack Snyder filmed the unfilmable. So I think it's really cool. And I think if anybody, you know, watched the film and liked the film, you know, still read the graphic novel and go back and take a look at it. Because it is one of, I think, one of the greatest comic book stories ever written. I love Watchmen. I love both the graphic novel and the film.
Awesome. I think that's great. Cool. Go ahead and remind everyone where they can catch up with you.
Sure. If you are into Supergirl, I host a podcast called Supergirl Radio about the CW Supergirl TV series and pretty much anything Supergirl related, Kara Zor-El related. We talk about all things comics and animated TV and film and Smallville and the Helen Slater movie. We've covered that. So if you like anything about Supergirl, we try to cover as much as we possibly can. So you can find that at supergirlradio.com. We're also on all social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all that jazz. I am also a contributor to a podcast about the DCEU, some of Zack Snyder's films, but also, you know, David Ayer and Patty Jenkins and all the other filmmakers that have contributed to the DCEU. But that podcast is called Justice League Universe Podcast. And I messed up the the link in the previous minute, but the correct website for it is jluniverse.podomatic.com. So you can check it out over there. It's a scene by scene analysis, so it's a little bit different than a minute by minute, but I really like participating in that because it gives me a chance to really practice, you know, film reviewing and looking at themes and characters. So I highly recommend it if anybody's into the DC films.
Right on. Well, thank you so much for joining us these last two episodes.
Well, thank you for having me. I don't get a chance to talk about Watchmen very much. I get it out every now and then to watch it just because every now and then I really get in the mood because I love Larry Fong so much. I like to think of myself as a camera operator. I, you know, sometimes will run a camera at my church. You know, I graduated with a degree in broadcast television production. I, you know, shoot some things on the side, you know, just on an amateur level. So I really look up to Larry Fong because I think he's one of the best cinematographers in the business. So every now and then I just get it out just to see all the pretty images, if I'm going to be honest.
Sure.
Watchmen is one of the most beautiful movies ever made. So it's so nice to be able to talk about it.
Well, like I said, very, very happy that, that we got you on here. So very, refreshing to hear, you know, I mean, for the most part, I think everyone, not everyone, for the most part, people have been very positive about the movie, but it's nice to hear you, your very enthusiastic words about the movie itself and Zack Snyder and Larry Fong. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I do have some of my own critiques, but sure. I think for the most part, I just think it's really I don't mean to throw this around so lightly, but the word cinematic masterpiece I think do apply to this film, and that I wouldn't say that about every film. So the fact that I use it for this one, I think it's very appropriate. So I enjoy talking about it.
Awesome. I think that's going to be where we end this episode. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Watchmen Minute. Eric, where can they find us on Facebook?
Yeah, you can like our page at facebook.com/Watchmen Minute. And of course, come and talk about... What should they talk about, Travis?
They should tell us happy anniversary.
Yeah. We appreciate that. At the on the Crime Busters Listener Society, the Facebook group.
That's going to do it for today. Minute 157. We will be back tomorrow for 158 on Wednesday. But until then, who watches The Watchmen?
We do.
We do.
1 minute at a time.
Watchmen are over. And the wind begins to howl.